What is up, my dudes? Welcome back to Olympia Oddities. I'm your host, Trista, and we're finally here. I'm back. I'm coming to you not live from my bedroom floor. It's really feeling like the good old days of Olympia Oddities when I first started out. Just me coming to you from the floor of my bedroom, about to tell you about some crazy shit that went down in this state that I love so much. We had a few delays in the process of me coming back. Most notably, I broke my tooth a couple months ago, and I was like, I can tough this out until my dentist appointment. And then roughly 3 days before I went to go get it checked out, I woke up and that side of my face was swollen, and I had a sore throat just on the side of my broken tooth. And I'm like, well, that's not good. So, did some antibiotics and fixed that. And then we had that crazy heat wave. And trying to record with the AC off during that stuff is just miserable. And also, I had to take advantage of the nice weather and go swimming with my best friend Janelle a couple times. So please forgive me for that. But I'm back. We're here. And it's going to be a good one. I can tell you that right now. Since this is my official return as the original and only host of Olympia Oddities, I decided what better way to celebrate this comeback than to have my return episode be something that really connects to the roots of this podcast, and something that's become a bit of an inside joke around here over the years. That's right, it's an episode about planes. While I do feel like one day I'm going to book a vacation and have a very sad day at the airport when I'm pulled aside to explain the dozens of pages of notes that I've taken on multiple plane hijackings, I really am just fascinated and horrified by them. And seriously, please don't worry, I'm absolutely terrified of flying. Today I'm going to be telling you the story of Richard Russell, a 28-year-old who worked for Horizon Air as a baggage handler, who seemingly just snapped one day, stole a plane, and flew it through the skies of Washington, even successfully completing a barrel roll before he crash-landed the plane on a small island in Puget Sound. This incident has been described as one of the most serious domestic airline security breaches since 9/11. I remember this happening well and following the story online and on the news, and I even have some friends who were witnesses to the plane's erratic flying or who listened in live to the pilots trying to talk him down. Let's get into it. The evening of August 10th, 2018 was clear and warm, all the norm for this time of year in Washington. What wasn't the norm, though, was the erratic break that Richard Bebo Russell had taken from his daily routine. Using a tug vehicle, he had just maneuvered an idling plane from its parking spot. While the plane was in idle, no one was holding the brakes down, so the propellers began to push the plane towards SeaTac's runways. He disconnected the tow bar of the tug vehicle, and in 7 seconds had sprinted to the plane's passenger entry door, which had been lowered. Inside the plane, he made his way to the pilot's chair and sat down. The events of what happened this night came as a shock to Richard Russell's family and friends, who called him Bebo. Bebo was a nickname that Richard had received as a baby. He was born in the Florida Keys, but spent his childhood in Alaska. His family lived in Wasilla, which is outside of Anchorage. He was raised in a military family who took playing by the rules very seriously. In a dedication from his family on his high school yearbook page for his senior year, they quoted a Bible verse that read, "Whoever enters an athletic competition wins the prize only when playing by the rules." In high school, he had played 3 sports, and he'd been good at all of them. He won 5th in the state for discus, 4th for wrestling in his weight class, and played fullback on their football team. His friends and family said that during football games, Richard had never shied away from contact on the field, and he had hit his head quite a few times, hard. After graduation, he was recruited to play football at North Dakota's Valley City State University. Unfortunately, though, his talent just didn't shine through during his college years, and he ended up spending a lot of time on the bench and not much time actually playing. His college football coach remembered Russell as a non-issue guy on our team in an interview with Rolling Stone. Richard Russell then moved to Coos Bay, Oregon. There he enrolled in the Southwestern Oregon Community College and found a new pastime to fill the hole that football had left. Jesus. He joined the Campus Crusade for Christ, an evangelical student group, or NERDS, if you will. He volunteered, helping as a mentor for high school students. And weirdly enough, this is the second time that Campus Crusade for Christ has popped up in one of my episodes. I remember it from Randall Woodfield, I believe that was the guy's name. He was the Green Bay Packer turned murderer, rapist, overall huge creep. And that was in Oregon too. So Oregon loves campus crusade. I can't ever say it right. Oregon loves the campus crusade for Christ. It's too many C's in a row. Got to work on that. Pete Schaefers, who was the adult advisor for Campus Crusade for Christ at SOCC, told Rolling Stone that, if you look at his picture, he looks like a smiling teddy bear kind of guy. You could count on him. He remembered him for his good nature and said that he never saw him in a bad mood. Richard ended up meeting his wife-to-be at one of the Campus Crusade meetings. Hannah was enrolled in the school's culinary program, and soon they were sitting next to each other at meetings. They got married in 2012, and 2 years later they opened up a bakery together. The business, called Hannah Marie's Artisan Bread, Artesian Well, sorry, it throws me off. It's an Olympian problem, you probably wouldn't get it. Anyways, Hannah Marie's Artisan Breads and Pastries got a write-up in the local newspaper. The article described Hannah as a masterful, perfectionist baker, and Richard as more of a jokester who liked to create wild flavor combinations. But just 2 years later, both Richard and Hannah had grown tired of how isolating Coos Bay could feel. They knew it was time for a move, but they didn't quite agree on where. Richard wanted to go back to Alaska, but Hannah wanted to move to Sumner, Washington, where she had family. Richard was unable to convince Hannah of the move to Alaska, so they settled on Sumner and sold the bakery. After settling in Sumner in 2015, Richard found a job with Horizon Air working as a baggage handler. He wasn't in love with the job, throwing heavy suitcases and being outside in all types of inclement weather, but it allowed him the freedom to travel to see his family back in Alaska. In 2017, he wrote in a blog post he was writing as part of a communications class that, "I've always felt bad for the guys and gals who handled luggage. Every time I traveled, I would look out my plane window and see these sullen-looking individuals throwing bags into a cart. It seemed like such miserable work." But his job didn't just allow him to travel back to his beloved Alaska. He took Hannah to Ireland and France and took vacations with his bros. But those trips to Alaska were the most important thing. He wrote in his blog, "Flight benefits were my last hope of seeing my beloved family and state on a regular basis." In December of 2017, he graduated with a bachelor's degree in social sciences from Washington State University. His communications class blog listed out a few possible goals for him after graduation, including joining the military, law enforcement, or joining the ranks of management at Horizon. Richard was described by those who knew him as compassionate, reliable, God-fearing, and goofy. Others described him as funny and extroverted. Another quote from his family in his yearbook dedication read, "You bring such humor and unpredictability to our lives. As you write this rest of the story, always remember you are loved." In other words, Richard Russell seemed like a totally normal dude. That's why the events of August 10th came as a complete shock to his employer and those who knew and loved him. He had clocked in for a shift at 2:30 p.m., which was his usual routine. He went about his day until 7 p.m. His window of opportunity had finally arrived. Still equipped in his reflective vest, he'd stolen a tow rig from SeaTac's Sea Concourse using his employee badge and driven it a mile, arriving at the north end of the airfield. This is where the plane in question, a Bombardier Q400, had been parked for maintenance. The 76-seat plane had just completed its last flight around noon that day, which was a short 23 minutes from Vancouver Island, BC, back to SeaTac. The airplane didn't have a lock on the door, and the cockpit was not secured. The biggest challenge that Richard would have to face during this hijacking attempt was the fact that getting the plane out of its parking spot was a two-man job, and he was a lone wolf, operating alone, without an accomplice. At 7:15, he attached the plane to the tow vehicle. He tossed aside the blocks for wheels and entered the plane. Inside the cockpit, he toggled levers and switches until the engine fired up. He exited the plane, got into the tow vehicle, and began towing the plane to the runways. This bold hijacking attempt had gone unnoticed due to the everyday hustle and bustle of the airport, and the one lone security staff member who was around had been busy attending to an arriving vehicle at the entrance gate. Not that the security guard noticing anything was going on, though, would have made much of a difference, as the report from the Port of Seattle, who operates SeaTac, reads, "Even if the guard had witnessed these actions, the time frame was too short to have precluded the Horizon employee's entry to the cabin of the aircraft." From the cockpit of the plane, Richard Russell slid up the levers for each of the propellers on the far side of the control panel from him. The SeaTac radio tower had spotted him by now and radioed down to him. Aircraft on Charlie lining up runway 16 center. Say your call sign. Reports say that when no response came from the erratic plane, the radio tower controller nearly yelled, "Who's the Dash 8 holding on runway 16 center?" Another pilot for Alaska Airlines responded to the tower saying, "That aircraft is taking off rolling. His wheels are smoking left and right, just rolling down the runway." According to the FBI's report on the incident, the Q400 achieved liftoff at 7:33 p.m. The plane was headed south in the direction of Mount Rainier. The Alaska Airlines pilot radioed to the control tower that, "You need to call and scramble now." The tower replied, "We are." About 10 minutes into Richard Russell's unauthorized flight, he made contact with an air traffic control operator at the Seattle Terminal Radar Approach Control, an FAA facility near SeaTac. In his voice, you can hear an edge of panic and worry to it, despite him speaking strongly and clearly. The recordings of these transmissions don't allow us to hear the question that the operator, Andrew Drury, asked Richard, but we're able to hear Richard's response. With a laugh, he says, "Man, I'm a ground service agent. I don't know what that is." While trying to explain why he had taken the plane, Richard told the operator that his plan was, "Start it up and get it to go. A couple of hours, I guess. I wouldn't know how to land it. I wasn't really planning on landing it. I just want to do a couple maneuvers, see what I can do before I put her down, you know?" NORAD began tracking the flight after the first call from SeaTac came 7 minutes after the plane had taken off. 4 minutes later, they had received an update, and it didn't sound good. The pilot sounded suicidal. Richard steered the plane in an arc around Mount Rainier, and NORAD briefly lost him on their radar. The radio had gone silent too, and for a few moments, they were left wondering. By 7:48, the plane pinged back onto the radar, rounding out its turn around the backside of the volcano. But then the plane made a troubling move. It began heading towards Seattle, and it was picking up speed. At this point, 15 minutes into the flight, and with a city's population at risk, a city that was holding several major events that night, like a Pearl Jam concert, did the Western Air Defense send out a call to scramble some F-15s. The Continental U.S. Chief of Operations at NORAD held off on this, though, telling the pilots just to suit up instead. Richard Russell's voice cracked back onto the radio. He explained the reasoning for his silence. He'd hit turbulence going around Mount Rainier, and he'd thrown up. His voice was missing some of the excited edge that it had only minutes earlier, and he apologized to the operator. "Sorry, my mic came up. I threw up a little bit. Man, I'm sorry about this. I hope this doesn't ruin your day." He gave the operator his name and asked him for advice, saying, "What do you think I should do, FAA guy?" The operator thought fast and decided to try to gauge Richard's competency at flying the plane. The operator asked, "Just flying the plane around, you seem comfortable with that?" And with that manic edge to his voice arriving again, Richard exclaimed, "Oh, hell yeah, it's a blast, man. I've played video games before, so you know, I know what I'm doing a little bit." Then, "Everything's peachy," he insisted. "Just did a little circle around Rainier. It's beautiful. I think I got some gas to go check out the Olympics," in reference to the Olympic mountain range. And I cannot imagine being the guy who's like, "Man, I was just having a normal night when all of a sudden, the craziest shit ever's happening, and now I'm trying to talk down this guy who's like, very clearly not in a right state of mind. He's up there going like, oh, I've played video games before. I can fly a plane. I've played video games before. I can't fly a plane. I think the only person who's ever been able to do that before was maybe Colton Harris Moore, not to bring him up again, but you know." Close to 8 p.m., Richard Russell began to ponder over the radio about what the possible outcome and consequences could be for this. He asked if the directions the operator had been giving him were leading him to jets that were going to take him down, and the operator explained to him that no, he wasn't, and that he was actually trying to keep him away from other aircraft that were attempting to land at SeaTac. Regret seemed to set in again for Richard, and he answered, "Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't want to screw with that. I'm glad you're not, you know, screwing up everyone else's day on account of me." The operator began trying to discuss a possible landing with Richard, but even suggesting this was a stressful task. The Q400 was a plane with high-powered engines, designed to climb sharply out of airports and into the sky. When the plane was full, it was high-powered. When the plane was empty, it was even more so. There's an inside joke with pilots where they refer to the plane as the Crash 8 because of how difficult it can be to land. The operator tried to point out a nearby runway, saying over the radio, "There's a runway just off to your right side in about a mile. Do you see that? That's McCord Field. McCord is a huge Army and Air Force base south of Tacoma, and Richard did not trust the operator's suggestion of landing there. Richard radioed, "Oh man, those guys would rough me up if I tried landing there. I think I might mess something up there too. I wouldn't want to do that." And then he basically shouts with paranoia, "Oh, they've probably got anti-aircraft." The operator tried to reassure Russell by saying, "No, they don't have any of that stuff," and explained that they were just trying to find some place that he could land safely. Richard responded, "Yeah, not quite ready to bring it down just yet, but holy smokes, I gotta stop looking at the fuel because it's going down quick. This is probably like jail time for life, huh? I mean, I would hope it is for a guy like me." The next part of Richard Russell's flight was captured on video by some citizens who were concerned at the low-flying, erratic aircraft. A woman can be heard in the video yelling, "What the hell?" A man's voice cuts in after hers, "Holy shit, it's a fucking Alaska Airlines Q400. What the fuck is he doing over here?" The air control operator Richard had been talking to was trying to connect him on the radio with a pilot, who they hoped might be able to successfully coach Richard into landing the plane. They gave the pilot a quick debrief on the situation, with the operator telling him, apparently he's a grounds crew with Horizon, I guess, and he just needs some help controlling his aircraft. Richard had been listening in and snapped back, "I mean, I don't need that much help." Then he confessed, "I would like to figure out how to get this cabin, make it pressurized or something, so I'm not so lightheaded." Over the next few minutes, the conversation between Richard Russell and the operator and pilot got even more disjointed and hard to follow. The professional pilot was trying to get some important info from Richard about the plane's altitude and speed. Richard replied, "I'm just kind of hand-flying right now." It seems that during this time, the plane went in and out of the range of the radio a few times, and Richard began complaining about something being in his ear. He exploded at the operator, "Damn it, Andrew, people's lives are at stake here." The FAA now issued a warning that Richard Russell was a danger and a threat, and finally NORAD scrambled fighter jets to leave out of the Portland airport. The military will not release exactly when the F-15s were able to intercept the Q-400, citing national security, but when Major John Dash Dalrymple, mission crew commander of the Western Air Defense Sector, testified to the Washington State Legislature, he claimed that it took the jets less than 7 minutes to catch up to the plane. That puts the timeline at around 8:15 p.m. The two jets that intercepted the plane were both equipped with heat and radar-seeking missiles, and a hot gun that held several rounds of 20mm rounds of ammunition. The 8:15 intercept means that the planes likely left PDX at 8:08, giving Richard nearly 20 minutes of free time, just flying around in the sky doing whatever the hell he wanted to. A NORAD official claimed that the slow response time was due to an unclear first call that came in. They claimed that the first call was for a departure without clearance, which could have just been a mistake, and did not inspire the urgency that a stolen aircraft call would have. The operator managed to keep their calm after Richard exploded at him and told him not to say stuff like that. Richard replied, "Nah, I don't want to hurt no one. I just want you to whisper sweet nothings into my ear." In just minutes, it seemed like the original over-the-top confidence Richard had at the start of his flight had returned once again. "Hey, you think if I land this successfully, Alaska will give me a job as a pilot?" he asked. The pilot who was coaching his flight returned, "I think that they would give you a job doing anything if you could pull this off." Snapping back, Richard snipped, "Yeah, right. Nah, I'm a white guy." Which is a little weird. We'll get into like some of the things that might have been a possible motive for his actions later. And there are unfortunately some parts of the internet that have like really latched onto this and like made him into a sort of folk hero instead of just a very troubled man who probably had some very, very scary final moments. And unfortunately, there's some hateful groups who have kind of tried to attach themselves to this because of that. Both air traffic control and the coaching pilot both began to approach the idea of a water landing with Richard. Richard brushed off their attempts to get him to land safe, saying, "I want the coordinates of that orca. You know, the mama orca with the baby." This was in reference to a member of a local orca pod, an orca named Taliqua, who had recently had her calf die, and her mourning ritual of carrying her dead calf's body with her for weeks had pulled at the heartstrings of America and made news around the country. A possible motive for the hijacking was revealed in Richard's radio communications during this flight. Somewhat unprompted, he said, "Minimum wage. We'll chalk it up to that." He added, "Maybe that will grease the gears a little bit with the higher-ups." SeaTac had recently adopted a $15 minimum wage, but due to some loopholes in the law, It had worked out that while the fast food employees inside the airport were making $15 an hour, some airport employees, like baggage handlers, were making up to $3 less than their fellow employees. The air traffic at SeaTac had come to a complete stop during the plane's hijacking. 75 flights were delayed, and 5 were canceled. John Ostrower, who was an aviation journalist, former CNN employee, and editor-in-chief at his own publication, recalled the night to Rolling Stone. He said, "I remember getting ready for dinner, and I started to think, it's really quiet. I stepped on the balcony, it was a beautiful evening, absolutely gorgeous, and I just didn't hear anything." Ostrower then headed to Twitter, which pointed him to the open air traffic control channels, and he was soon listening in to Richard's back and forth with air control. He could hardly believe what he was listening to, saying, "Given everything that's gone on since 9/11, you shouldn't be able to steal a commercial airliner and take off from the 9th busiest airport in the country." Now with 2 fighter jets following him close behind, Richard maneuvered the plane in the direction of the Olympic Mountains. His tone grew reflective, and he began saying goodbyes to his loved ones. He said, "I got a lot of people that care about me, and it's going to disappoint them to hear that I did this. I would like to apologize to each and every one of them. I'm just a broken guy, got a few screws loose, I guess. Never really knew it until now." A little before 8:30, Richard looked out and got a glimpse of the Olympic mountain range. He asked over the radio, "Man, have you been to the Olympics? These guys are gorgeous. Holy smokes." NORAD had assembled a team to try to figure out what to do about the entire situation. The jets that were following Richard had been authorized to headbutt, a move where they would execute a sharp turn in front of his plane, or to drop flares as a warning to try to get Richard to comply. They never actually executed any of these plans, though, because Richard's flying had just become too erratic. As he steered the plane back towards the southern area of Puget Sound, Richard asked the pilot an alarming question. "Hey, pilot guy, can this thing do a backflip, you think?" Just minutes before 8:30 p.m., it seemed that Richard had come up with a plan of his own. He told them, "I think I'm just going to try to do a barrel roll, and if that goes good, then I'll just nose down and call it a night." He continued on. The sights went by so fast. "I was thinking, like, I'm going to have this moment of serenity, you know? I'll be able to take in all the sights. There's a lot of pretty stuff. But, I think they're prettier in a different context." A few minutes passed, and Richard's voice cracked onto the radio again. It was 8:43 p.m. "I feel like I need to be, what do you think, like 5,000 feet at least to be able to pull this barrel roll off?" And then, somehow, he did it. The plane climbed up in the sky before tumbling over clockwise. The plane rolled down in a spin and then nearly went vertical as it stumbled into another roll. Straightening out just above the waters of Puget Sound, the plane continued through the skies as if nothing had ever happened. It seems truly unbelievable, but a witness was able to capture video of the barrel roll attempt. Track of Interest 1 is what the F-15 pilots were referring to the Q-400 as on the radar, and one of the fighter pilots came on with noticeable awe in his voice. TOI-1 just completed a barrel roll. The other pilot responded, slightly incredulous but remaining professional, "Confirm he did a barrel roll?" The first pilot replied, "Affirm," with a laugh of disbelief. He cleared the surface of the water by about 10 feet. The pilot who was trying to coach the flight popped onto the radio. "All right, Rich, this is Captain Bill. Congratulations, you did that. Now let's try to land that airplane safely and not hurt anybody on the ground." Richard responded, "All right. Ah, damn it. I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't want to. I was kind of hoping that that was going to be it, you know?" The last transmission that came from Richard flying the Q-400 was concerning. He was low on fuel, but he said, "Not for long." Then, "I feel like one of my engines is going out or something." Just moments later, at 8:46 p.m., the plane fell from the sky, crashing into the woods of Keetron Island. The small island is located between Olympia and Tacoma, and the plane had crashed on the southern end of the woods. The plane had torn down trees as it crashed, and its wings were ripped from the fuselage. A 2-acre fire spread from the plane wreck. It was determined in the FBI report that Richard Russell had died from multiple traumatic injuries. The FBI also determined that while the plane had shown signs of flying with only one engine, the crash appeared to have been intentional. The flight record data showed that 6 seconds prior to the crash, the nose of the plane had been pushed even closer down to the ground. At 8:46, the fiery crash led to the end of Richard's joy flight, which had lasted 73 minutes. In the aftermath of the crash and the events of that night, the FBI determined that Richard Russell had acted alone and without an accomplice. He hadn't left any sort of manifesto. He had died by suicide and was not connected to any sort of terrorist organization or ideology. Investigators got to work interviewing Richard's family, friends, and coworkers to try to determine the cause of all of this, but no answers were ever really revealed. They did confirm that Richard had sent a text to his wife, Hannah, during the flight, and that the general message of the text was that she deserved better. While the FBI couldn't find any real rhyme or reason to Richard Russell's actions, there were certainly several possible red flags. The first was Richard's quiet and long-held fascination with flight. On an online profile of his, he had written that he flew as much as he possibly could, and that a float plane tour through Alaska's Misty Fjords National Monument was one of the best experiences in his life. For one of his graphic design assignments at Washington State University, he designed a logo, suitcases with straps reading Russell Hustle, and a circular blue badge featuring a silhouette of what he described as a minimalistic Q400 in the center. While these details are easier to write off or explain away, other red flags aren't. A pilot at SeaTac told the investigators that he had caught Richard twice in his planes, acting suspiciously. In the first encounter, Richard had shown an interest in the pilot's pre-flight flows, or startup sequence for the plane. The second incident had happened about a year before Richard had stolen the plane. During this incident, the pilot had found Richard and another ground service crew member inside his plane, flipping switches. The pilot thought that this wasn't just a plot that this guy came up with, like, overnight. This guy had been thinking about doing this for a long time, and the Q400 that he took was just an airplane of opportunity. The Port of Seattle created an after-incident report that suggested the ways that security could be beefed up and prevent another incident like this from happening. Those suggestions included mental health screening and services for the broader population of workers with restricted area access, and mandating two-person teams for all functions involving aircraft access. The report stressed that while additional safety measures could be added, they would not come without significant cost. So while the port and TSA didn't make any changes in the aftermath, NORAD did. Air defense sectors are now allowed to act without waiting for approval from their higher-ups. By allowing them to make their own decisions on when to scramble jets, they hope that future response time can be improved. Richard's former Campus Crusade advisor said, "Something snapped. I heard someone who was very troubled, and I think he knew it. But it was amazing to me as I listened, the sense of him not wanting to hurt anyone. And it was still him. The kindness was still there. The good-heartedness was still there. Obviously, leaving people behind was very harmful, but that's a different aspect." In a statement released by Richard Russell's family after his death, they wrote, "Bebo was a warm, compassionate man. He was a faithful husband, a loving man, and a good friend." They explained how they were completely shocked by his actions. They added that Russell was right when he had mentioned all the people who had loved him. One friend of Russell described receiving the video of the plane jacking from another friend. This friend told the Times that, "Rolling out of bed and hearing his voice, my initial reaction was, oh, what kind of prank is he playing? This is going to be hilarious. I just thought it was another one of his jokes." A friend who had recently talked to Russell just 2 months before the plane incident told the Anchorage Daily News, "He sounded perfectly fine, just the same old Bebo." This friend also said that their son had talked to him just 1 week prior to the incident, and nothing had seemed off to him at all. Former football teammates of Richard's wonder if his football head injuries, specifically CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, had something to do with this. Richard's stepbrother, Danny Puntaro, agreed with this theory, telling the media, "My only hypothetical that kind of fits is possibly injuries from playing football. He did suffer some concussions, so in my mind, it was a little bit out of his hands." One of the stranger aspects to come out of the plane crash was Richard Russell's elevation to the status of folk hero, mainly on the internet. There's Reddit threads and Facebook pages dedicated to him, calling him Sky King. Visitors on these pages wrote how they felt like they were mourning the loss of someone that they never knew, but felt like they did. And some even empathized with his actions. Others just comment, "Sky King," with a series of following flame emojis on Facebook posts covering the story. T-shirts with slogans like, "Puget Sound Flight Club," "Fly It Like You Stole It," began popping up. Folk songs like, "Looking for That Orca," and "Sky King, A Song for Richard Russell," were posted on YouTube. Alt-right fanatics clung to his "But I'm a white guy" statement and started clinging on to the Sky King name as well. In reality, Richard Russell was a troubled man. There's no debating that. He commandeered a plane with no exit strategy and spent his final moments in regret and afraid and probably covered in his own puke. He was educated. He was employed. He had hobbies and goals and dreams. He had loved ones. He had a wife. And he ended it all for reasons that we will probably never be fully sure of. His family and loved ones aren't a fan of his story becoming an internet meme. It's a painful reminder to them every time it pops up. One bright side that comes out of Richard Russell's story is the fact that somehow, miraculously, no one other than himself got hurt. With a baseball game and a Pearl Jam concert going on that night in Seattle, it's not hard to imagine how tragic this could have been if the plane had gotten out of control or if Richard had wanted to hurt someone other than himself. If the plane had been hijacked by someone with bad or terroristic intent, the outcome could have been a lot different, with a stadium full of baseball and Pearl Jam fans and the Space Needle all directly in the path of this commandeered plane. Thank you for listening to another episode of Olympia Oddities. You can follow my Facebook group or Instagram for the podcast at Olympia Oddities Podcast. If you want to help support the podcast, you can leave me a 5-star review, share the pod on social media, or tell a friend about me. You can find some of my sweet merch at my Tee Public shop, which you can also find in our Instagram bio or by Googling Olympia Oddities Podcast. I'm Trista, and my personal Instagram is at Saloon Ghost. And until next time, friends.